We're going to be looking at today's first reading under four headings: a picture in a dream, a promise from God, a place to remember, and finally, a pledge of loyalty. First then, the picture that accompanies God speaking to Jacob. I guess I may not be alone among those who are middle-aged or older in still being surprised when I call someone on the phone and before I've said anything, they reply, "Hello, Andrew." And my first thought is always, how did they know it's me? Followed 2 seconds later by remembering this is 2018 and not the 1970s when I grew up. And for at least 20 years, mobiles and even often landline phones tell you the name or the number of the caller before you decide to pick up. For those who like customizing their smartphones, you can get it to flash with a particular picture specific to who's ringing. So you might want the following warning before you accept a call. Or perhaps that image might help you on other occasions. If you want something for when your mum is on the line, there was quite a choice of pictures you could choose from. I like that one there, or others might prefer that one there. One day, they say they will have the technology to communicate these kinds of messages to us without our needing even to pick up a screen, sending the relevant image directly to the brain. But one way of looking at what's happening at the start of this section of Genesis is to say that God had got there first with that kind of idea. Sending a picture to Jacob, not via an electronic screen, but instead while he is dreaming. We'll think more about what the picture communicates later on. But one initial way to think about it is as God announcing to Jacob that he is getting in touch. Remember, a key principle of the Old Testament is that God doesn't want to communicate his nature through images of his own being in the way that other nations saw things happening. So a ladder pointing upwards with angels going up and down is a pretty good way of saying who is about to be speaking. A picture, a promise. The promise that's almost an exact reiteration of the promise first made to Jacob's grandfather, Abraham. It begins fairly modestly, verse 13, "I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your offspring." Jacob, like Abraham and Isaac, was a nomad. True, the families were, by the standards of the day, very well off. But there were downsides to a traveling lifestyle, and they would have treasured a promise from God that one day their descendants would be able to settle down, plant and harvest crops, live in houses rather than tents, and call that land their own. There was more though. Verse 14, "Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south." Being like dust might sound like a bad thing until it becomes clear that the people that descended from Jacob will be like dust in the sense of being as commonplace and as numerous as particles of dust. So extensive has the family grown. And with the ownership of the land, they need to support themselves as well. Verse 15 continues the theme of the Lord's personal blessing on Jacob and his descendants. "Behold, I am with you, and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I promised you." And for the subsequent readers of the book of Genesis in Old Testament times, they would have known that these promises were indeed to come true. Because in time Jacob was given by God another name. The children of Jacob were the children of Israel. And that's who they were as the readers of the book. And they had indeed come to live in the land God had promised to Abraham and now to Jacob. To the west and the east and the north and the south of the place, which, as we see later, came to be called Bethel. There's one other part of the promise that I want to go back to, which is of particular significance for us, for the majority of the world who are not members of the family of Israel genetically. The second half of verse 14. And in you, in Jacob, and your offspring, shall all the families of the earth be blessed. People sometimes struggle with the idea of God having a chosen people, the children of Israel, in Old Testament times. But they are chosen and blessed as part of a bigger plan to bring God's blessing to all the families of the earth. A plan that was fulfilled through the coming of Christ and the subsequent extension of God's promises to us as Gentiles. A picture in a dream, a promise from God. Readers of Genesis might be wondering what Jacob's response is going to be to what God has communicated to him. Because actually we know almost nothing of what kind of personal faith Jacob had before this point. We know quite a lot about what he got up to though. Because Jacob was the younger of Isaac's two sons, albeit only by a matter of minutes, that meant that Esau, the eldest, would have usually inherited the family birthright and his father's blessing. But Jacob had found an opportunity to snatch each of those in turn. First of all, catching Esau when he was ravenously hungry and getting Esau to sell his birthright for a bowl of soup. A mess of pottage. And then successfully following his mother's plan to deceive his dying father, Isaac, into thinking he was blessing the elder, Isaac Esau, as many will remember, by wearing goatskins to make his arms seem hairier like Esau's were. Now, perhaps surprisingly, as we read both Old and New Testament, it isn't actually clear whether or not Jacob is to be praised for his enterprise in all that or rebuked for his deceit. We don't know either if he would have been told of the promises of God that had been made to his father Abraham and treasured them, maybe that even motivating his desire to be the recipient of his father's blessing. Or it could be the other way. It could be if he's to be seen as the kind of selfish person who wouldn't have cared about the things of God. But whatever Jacob's faith or lack of it before this incident, now it's clear that having heard God speak to him directly, he responds in trust and obedience. First of all, by establishing that spot as a place to remember, a place of worship. Verse 16, then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he'd put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel. I'm sure most of us will have driven through parts of the UK and especially Wales and noticed many chapels given that name, Bethel. And the reason why that practice caught hold in this country, well, because Bethel means simply house of God. And indeed, when the Israelites had returned to the promised land, this time as its rulers, Bethel was for a while an important enough place of worship to be one of the four places where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. In God's dealings with his Old Testament people, the place where they worshipped particularly mattered. Partly it was the importance of their being willing to obey the Lord in using the places he gave them to worship and avoiding the places that he forbade. Partly because, as with Bethel, being in the exact place where the Lord had revealed himself had a good chance of prompting people to think what that revelation had been about, to remember God's promise. As you traveled to Bethel to worship, it was pretty much in the center of ancient Israel. You'd think where other people came from, to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west, and realize that God had fulfilled that part of his promise. You'd see it, there were surrounding hordes of Israelites, that you were settled in the land. And all that would remind you that what the Lord had promised to the patriarchs, to Abraham, and especially to Jacob at Bethel, had now been kept, had now been fulfilled. Jacob establishes a place to remember God's passing on this wonderful promise. Fourthly, we read of the pledge that Jacob makes. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I've set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a tenth to you." I think we still see in Jacob's word something of the schemer, the deal maker. But those words are nonetheless a real pledge that as God keeps his promises to Jacob, Jacob will pledge his loyalty to the Lord. As I promised earlier, we're going to go back to the picture Jacob was given. Because it wasn't just sent for him, but for us too, as a graphic demonstration that through God's grace, there is now no longer an impermeable barrier between heaven and earth. Earlier on in the book of Genesis, after the disobedience of chapter 3, the story concludes with God posting an angel, a cherubim, with a flaming sword at the entrance to Eden, so that the human race cannot get back in. And we might have thought that if we weren't even allowed to go back to the Garden of Eden, any contact between heaven and earth would be out of the question. But the picture we're now given in this later chapter of Genesis of a staircase opening up to heaven, of God's messengers, the angels, going to and fro, indicates otherwise. In his grace, God is now providing a channel between himself and his world, between heaven and earth. Since the time of Christ, it's a channel that's open not just for the genetic family of Jacob, the children of Israel, but for all. And as we hear God's words of promise, of invitation, the question is, will we close our ears and shut our eyes? Or, like Jacob, will we respond to the Lord by accepting his hand as it stretches out from heaven to earth, and with our pledge to own him as our God from now on? Amen.